Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hello, it's Kitty Martone, Healthy Gut Girl, and this is Stuff Your Doctor Should Know. I'm coming to you live from deep inside your large intestine. And do you know that almost every single episode I do, at some point during the episode, we talk about the gut? Is that nuts? Even no matter what it is, no matter what. I mean, maybe like if I was off topic and we were like when I had King of Phillips on and we were talking about the Explorers Club. But even so, let me tell you, if you're going to be exploring the planet, you better be sure to have your gut health in order, or else you're going to be susceptible to every kind of pathogen that you are exposed to in shower water, drinking water, ice cubes. So we probably did talk about gut health then too. I'm telling you, everything comes down to what is the state of your gut. Like, are you digesting the food you're eating well? Are you absorbing the nutrients from that food? And are you excreting the waste matter from that food? No matter what it is, I don't care if it's macaroni and cheese or peanut butter jelly or Chick-fil-A or something super healthy. Are you breaking it down and, you know, doing what you need to be doing with it? Anyway, we'll talk about all that another time. I am so excited about today's guest, and I know I say that a lot, but this guest is just amazing in a million different ways. You have to also watch the video on YouTube because she's adorable, and you have to follow her on Instagram, and you have to listen to her YouTube series on hair loss. She's brilliant. Her name is Jessica Ash. She doesn't really need any introduction because she's so ultra cool. And if you know anything about hormones, then you know who Jessica Ash is. So take some notes and enjoy. So I have this estrogen dominance support group, and I've had it for 7 years. I started at the same time I started my podcast, and it's, you know, slowly growing and growing because of all the hormonal issues that all of us deal with. And it's gotten really, really popular. And it's more so in like the last 4 years or so. And the women get younger and younger and younger who join it. When I joined it, it was a lot of women in perimenopause and stuff. Constantine is the one who introduced me to you. And then I was like, I posted some of your stuff in the group, and everyone already knew who you were. And I was like, oh, I'm late to the game here. So he introduced me, and I said, gosh, I don't know her, she covers so many important topics. I'm not sure how to narrow this down. But what I have noticed is over the years, over these 7 years, what has become more and more of a daily thing that I'm addressing and we're all talking about is, yeah, fibroids, PCOS, all the things we grow, right? Polyps, right. Cysts, tumors, all of it. And, you know, of course, we're always talking about weight and insulin resistance as well every day.
Right.
But this one, I think, is really something I wanted to touch on with you. Okay. So I guess my first question, I want to kind of start with PCOS, but aren't these masses all just some level of estrogen gone rogue manifesting in each individual woman in the way that they manifest things?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Because I kind of saw you put like adrenal fatigue, PCOS, stress, and they all kind of go with each other. Mm-hmm. And with PCOS, you know, a lot of women who they get diagnosed with PCOS oftentimes wrongly, just absolutely wrongly, because they're growing like a cyst on their ovary, which is like a benign cyst, which is different than PCOS. That's the confusion, which is PCOS is really a metabolic disorder that has a lot to do with not making enough progesterone, not ovulating regularly, and also having a usually an underfunctioning thyroid and overfunctioning adrenals. So that, you know, we can hit on that if you want to just kind of bring it back to like, no matter what symptoms you're struggling with, whether it's kind of the acne or the weight gain, insulin resistance, or the hair loss, this is all a lack of energy issue. Your cells are having a hard time utilizing the energy that they need. And the body's having to prioritize energy for survival. The body is stuck in kind of a chronic survival state.
Okay. Yeah. So And that's PCOS now. So even maybe someone has really, really, really poor DHEA or I mean a really high DHEA, and then they're having these testosterone issues and androgen issues. Even that's not the core, that's not the center of the onion, is it? It still goes back down to this energetic metabolic dysfunction.
Exactly. The overproduction of the androgens is protective against estrogen. And also, a lot of times, it's the sex hormone binding globulin. There's that hormone in there that usually binds to testosterone and estrogen. Whereas when there's PCOS, there's usually a dysfunction in that sex hormone binding globulin. So you have all this free testosterone that's unchecked. So that's usually what's happening.
Wow, say that again. The DHT, I mean, that it's protective against estrogen. Will you say that again?
Testosterone. So we have, estrogen's kind of this catabolic, or estrogen's an anabolic or building hormone of growth, and testosterone is kind of too. But testosterone is one of the only hormones that's powerful enough to protect against estrogen. But it's also able, unfortunately, to aromatize into estrogen. So when women who have PCOS are making so much testosterone, oftentimes because of their lack of progesterone, they're turning that testosterone into estrogen in the liver constantly. So lots of
Wow.
little, and the DHEA, that high adrenal androgen, it's an effect of the body's having a hard time regulating hormones. So DHEA is that precursor to both estrogen and testosterone. The body's making so many of these hormones that the adrenals are now picking up some of that slack and pumping out more DHEA to turn into estrogen and testosterone.
Wow.
So it, yeah.
And so the testosterone is not what's causing these androgen issues. It's the aromatization of the testosterone to the estrogen. Is that right?
Yes and no. Testosterone is driving those symptoms of maybe like hair growth on the face or the hair loss, but it's always symptoms don't necessarily mean that it's a bad. Sometimes we look at symptoms and we say symptoms are the worst part of what's going on, but in fact, the symptoms can just be a result of the body having these dysregulated hormones. So the body is choosing to prioritize utilizing energy to create testosterone for a reason. It's not just, doing that. The body doesn't just spend energy willy-nilly. It's very intentional and purposeful about what it's going to do. So yes, the testosterone is definitely will cause symptoms, but the bigger things that are driving behind there is that excessive amount of estrogen that's stuck in the tissues. A lot of times there's just low progesterone. And then on top of it, we have all this stress, like just so much adrenaline, cortisol, all these stress hormones, which is directly suppressing the thyroid. And in a lot of scientific circles, the thyroid's considered the third ovary. So when the thyroid's dysfunctioning, really the sex hormones will always be dysfunctioning. That's why so many women, they get put on thyroid medication and they immediately will get pregnant. It's because it's needed to get the energy into the cell, the glucose into the cell.
Whoa. The third ovary. Oh my goodness. Okay. That really sheds light in a whole different way. Okay. So then PCOS. Now, let me see. There was a bunch of questions about PCOS. PCOS. I listed them all. I know we can't get to them all, but we can try. And they have so many good questions. So I was like, I'm just going to add these. Usually I save questions to the end, but this is so good. Let me find them. You can keep talking about PCOS if you want.
And some other things that women need to understand is most of the women that I've worked with PCOS struggling with this, I call it firstborn child syndrome. So a lot of women who struggle with PCOS are the firstborn child, and they often have this immense amount of pressure put on top of them to succeed, make achievements, whether their parents were consumed with, educational success or financial success. Most women I've talked to, very rarely are they an easygoing, like, oh, I don't really care about perfectionism. They're almost always a type A perfectionist going to advanced school, beyond bachelor's. They're doing master's, PhDs. They're often very driven and very masculine dominated roles. So, like, lawyer, doctor, which obviously women are becoming more dominant in these careers now, but it's still very much a, I guess, a masculine oriented energy that's going
Yeah,
on, that very,
alpha energy, alpha
yeah,
driven type
dominant,
A.
aggressive, very like you're kind of battling for ego. And I find that when women are, a lot of them are carrying a lot of baggage and trauma from their childhood, their teenage years. They push themselves from the very beginning of their lives. And so, of course, by the time they're in their early 20s, mid 20s, late 20s, mid 30s, they're burned out. Their adrenals are burned out. Their thyroid is suppressed. And usually during that time, they were not feeding themselves well. You know, they were running off of energy drinks and black coffee and just kind of snacking when they could. And so they have this kind of multi-layered trauma of they are in career paths that maybe a lot of them didn't even really want to be in. They just kind of did it because that was what was expected of them. And they're also putting themselves under immense amounts of pressure to be perfect, to achieve beyond what they are physically capable of achieving, in the amount of time that they're giving themselves. And so there's that extra added emotional pressure of just always going to the next level, nitpicking oneself constantly, putting oneself down, constantly feeling like they're a failure because they're never meeting their impossible expectations. And that also adds another layer of adrenal fatigue, if we want to call it that, or burnout, because even if you're in the most like stoic environment, you're eating well, you're taking, you know, the hormones you need to be taking, whatever you're doing, if you're constantly in this cycle inside of your body, inside of your mind, of just it's stressful. You're causing your own stress. And so that is often another layer to PCOS that gets overlooked. I would say 99% of the time is what expectations are you rising to meet? Are they really your own, or are they ones that have been instilled into you? And what type of pressure are you putting on yourself and your body?
That is insanely cool in a crazy, fascinating way, right? It's almost like, I've been doing the Dutch and offering the Dutch for quite a while now, and like probably 5 years. And over this time, I just noticed that there was this correlation between these girls, these women who had really high DHEA, high androgen issues, looking like maybe they had already been diagnosed with PCOS, or maybe they have not been diagnosed. But I started to ask, like, because it was so much of a coincidence. I started to say, what do you do exactly for a living? Like, what exactly, tell me a little bit about your upbringing and stuff. And across the board, I did not have one person that didn't have, like, they were getting their second PhD, or they were getting, they had a family of brothers and they were the youngest, and their dad was expecting them to be like them, and high levels of competition in the family. So a lot of them were really extreme athletes that have been, been competing for a long time. And all of them, not all of them were athletes, but all of them had some semblance of a type of overachievement, perfectionism, and highly stressed. And then they were coming up on their perimenopausal years and getting to this point where they just completely couldn't do it anymore, couldn't get pregnant. Were just like had these brittle adrenals and were just falling apart, and their hair was falling out. It was such and I said there has to be this connection. So for the fact that you just said that, it's very cool. I mean, it's not cool at all, but it's fascinating, right?
And it's interesting that you said earlier, you know, you're noticing it younger and younger. And that's what we're starting to see, because we're seeing now that generation that was raised by the mothers that are going through, you know, perimenopause and menopause. These are women that didn't realize there was any other way. And so they raised their daughters that way as well. And, you know, at younger us, we're starting to realize we can't do it anymore. We're hitting that wall at 20, 25, 30, and realizing there's a different way. There has to be, because we can't go on this way. We're gonna literally kill ourselves.
That is so interesting. Of course, I mean, it's the generations after that end up paying the price for those things, right? Just talking to Stephanie Center about this with glyphosate and how they did this test on these rats, and it wasn't the immediate rat that had the exposure to all the glyphosate that experienced the worst stuff. It was the generations to follow that end up dealing with consequences of continually doing those things and then teaching them to your kids. And yeah, that's incredible. Well, there's so much to say about that, because that means, we've got, it's a good thing because we can actually work on that. We can work not just on taking the progesterone and fixing our hypometabolic state, but we can start to recognize where we have those habitual things we do that keep us in that Gotta do it, gotta get it, gotta run. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Amazing. Look, we're only a few minutes in and my brain is just popped open already. Okay. I heard PCOS is autoimmune. What is the mechanism for manifestation? If you were diagnosed once, is it always present?
Well, I have heard, I'm sure you've maybe heard of it in your group, but there's this going around, and I think it was originally created by Dr. Lara Brighton. I'm not sure, but the four types of PCOS. So it's kind of classified into these four types, where which is, I think, lean PCOS or adrenal rate related PCOS, insulin resistant PCOS, autoimmune PCOS, or inflammatory PCOS, something like that, and then post-birth control PCOS. Like, don't quote me on that, but I think that's, they kind of
Yeah, that sounds familiar.
categorize the types of PCOS. And I have heard within that span of inflammatory PCOS, some people are talking about it being autoimmune. But when you go back and you actually look at the research, autoimmune rates are so much higher in women, and there's a reason for that. Estrogen, excessive estrogen, is a huge driver in autoimmune diseases. And the reason that I found that out is because when I was struggling with all my mystery issues, hormonal issues, is I kept getting diagnosed with Hashimoto's, and then I'd get diagnosed with lupus, because what was happening is in my body I had such an imbalance of minerals and hormones, but I had such estrogen dominance, so much estrogen in my tissues, and that's a long story, that it was driving an inflammatory or almost an autoimmune type reaction. And I was just experiencing that in my joints, in my skin, in my gut, and it was kind of moving. And I think when people get obsessed, because autoimmune diseases and chronic illness now is kind of popping off, which a lot of people are struggling, I understand that, but they chase down this kind of chronic illness rabbit hole of, this might be the answer because, this is why I haven't been able to lose the weight, or, I have an autoimmune disease. And they kind of use that as a label or a way to say, like, this is why I can't make any strides. And if there is autoimmune drivers behind PCOS, okay, but there's a reason why there are drivers behind autoimmunity as well. It's not, autoimmunity is not just kind of this like thing that happens, magical thing that happens randomly. There are real physical drivers behind autoimmunity, and some of those are very hormonal. Estrogen is a huge part in that.
It kind of goes back to that, peeling away the onion analogy, because they do that with inflammation too, right? If you go, you hear Dr. Oz and all these like celebrity doctors talking about inflammation, it's the cause of everything. And it's like, well, that's not really the cause. There's a cause of the inflammation as well, and there's a cause of the autoimmune diseases as well. So yeah, that makes perfect sense.
And I think there's a confusion too, that a lot of women think that PCOS has something to do with their ovaries, and it doesn't. The reason why it's called polycystic ovarian syndrome, many cyst ovarian syndrome, in the medical literature, cysts and follicle are used interchangeably. So if you look at it as many follicle ovarian syndrome, what's happening is many women with PCOS are not ovulating regularly. And if you know what happens before ovulation, there are a few follicles that have to, they call, you can say they're racing towards ovulation, and only one follicle becomes the dominant follicle that actually drops the egg during ovulation. And so when a woman gets an intravaginal ultrasound before she ovulates, there are going to be many follicles that show up on that ultrasound because one hasn't become that dominant follicle and dropped that egg for ovulation. And so the many follicle ovarian syndrome is showing up as many follicles on the ultrasound, but that doesn't really have, that's not a cyst growing on the ovaries. That's a completely separate issue. Cysts growing are a completely different thing. You can have cysts that grow and have polycystic ovarian syndrome, but you can also have these kind of benign cysts that grow during ovulation and not have PCOS. They're two completely separate issues. And I think a lot of women get confused because many doctors are confused. They're just throwing around diagnoses of PCOS without even going by the diagnosis criteria, which actually requires an ultrasound, requires either high androgens on a test or androgenic symptoms. And there's one, I think, one other thing. There's two different type of diagnoses or diagnosis criterias, different kind of categories, but most doctors don't know this either.
That's shocking. That's shocking, because I was actually told, because by one of my doctors, one of the many I fired, that I had a cyst that just would not, I would get it removed, it'd come back, get it removed, come back. And finally, progesterone removed it itself. But that particular doctor told me, I said, do I have PCOS? This was a long before I even knew what progesterone or even what luteal phase meant. And I said, does that mean I have this PCOS thing that women get cysts all over their ovaries? And she goes, you can pretty much guarantee that if you have a cyst on your ovary, you've got PCOS.
Interesting.
You know, and then you said the problem for you was that, and for so many women, is they have so much estrogen in their tissues. Now, this has become, my group has never really been divided, but now there's starting to be two camps because we're starting to really kind of shine light on the repeat research and all of this stuff, all this information that you drop, and all this, you know, studies that are connected with it, showing that it's, you know, we. That it's going into the tissue, that the estrogen is going into the tissue. And we know, and I say this a million times, and I'll say it right now to all my listeners who are on the other camp, the estrogen camp, is we're not against estrogen. Like the healthy balance of estrogen is really, really what we're talking about. And supplementing estrogen, which I used to say, hey, if your levels are low, go for it. And now, especially now that I work for Ona's, natural, you know, they sell estradiol and estriol. I am hyper careful about saying, yeah, just take estrogen. It's like, please, even if your levels show that they're low, you might have estrogen in your tissues. So let's start with progesterone first. Anyway, I brought that up because I think it's really important what you said, that, you know, you can have the estrogen in your tissues and this can be aggravating things and you don't even realize it. And here you think you have low estrogen and you're getting confused about your symptoms. But that I think is super important, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And we have to understand that there are financial drivers behind the emphasis on estrogen. There have been financial drivers, big money going into estrogen research since the 1960s, ever since birth control was made legal. And since that time, it's kind of the functional medicine space has kind of taken over for the Western medicine. That kind of Western medicine was pushing the need for estrogen because there were a lot of hysterectomies being done in like the 70s, 80s, 90s, and it was kind of like, well, if you get they were doing full hysterectomies, I would say kind of recklessly, where they're taking all the organs. They're not just taking the uterus, they were taking the ovaries and the cervix as well. And what was happening is these women were rapidly, their bones were rapidly deteriorating because they were getting these at young ages, 30s, 40s, 50s. And so they came out with the estrogen, that kind of estrogen patch that was so popular. And then over time, the research really went in that direction because the money was going in that direction. And then in the recent years, I mean, really in the past 20 years, bioidentical hormone replacement therapy has really blown up. And so the functional space has really taken over by just prescribing estrogen and really taking the research that was done to promote estrogen and using it and kind of adopting it to push the importance of estrogen in bone health the vaginal tissue health and all these things. Whereas we have to be really cautious about where this research is coming from, because the way research is done is they'll take something, they'll quote unquote prove it, and then the next research study is built on what was already proven. When in reality, what was proven was never really proven. And that's why Dr. Ray Peet's work is so just mind-blowing, is because he's going back and he's saying this was actually never really proven. It's just been adopted as truth, but when we look at the research, it's very much not proven that estrogen is actually good. The reason why you're feeling so good is because it can have these kind of cocaine-like effects. It's very stimulatory. It's a stress hormone in high amounts when it's imbalanced. And that's where, you know, we have to really understand there's nuance, right? The bloodstream is a highway for hormones, just like the urine or anything else. When we're excreting something or moving something, that's not always reflective of what's actually going on within the cell. And that's where blood tests and even urine tests and things like that, they can only go so far. And that's why it's so important to look at your body's context. I've seen so many perimenopausal and menopausal women go to functional medicine doctors and they get just slapped. It's just that kind of like basic, like go on progesterone, estrogen, and testosterone, and like, boop, go on your merry way. And I've seen so many perimenopausal women who have clear signs of estrogen dominance being put on estrogen and being told, no, that's a sign of low estrogen. You need more estrogen, more estrogen. And then what happens is they'll immediately gain a bunch of weight or their thyroid function will plummet. And now they have to be prescribed thyroid medication. Now they need to be prescribed. They're starting to get depressed. So now, oh, antidepressants or all of my fancy supplements, my nutraceuticals. So it becomes women get stuck on this merry-go-round and they're just caught chasing their symptoms, not realizing that possibly them being prescribed estrogen in the first place is might be driving this. I've seen women develop fibroids, having to get hysterectomies, things like that. And nobody ever said, hey, is it possible that it's the estrogen you're taking, that you're getting all these growths?
But then they say, but my libido's back and my vaginal atrophy is gone. So yes. Don't touch that. I want to stay on. And this is our point is like, listen, you know, it's just taking the pharma medical model and putting it into the functional practitioner, health practitioner model, and it's sticking it, that model into the functional space. And it's a pill for every ill, right?
Yeah.
Oh, you're low on testosterone. Here's some testosterone. Oh, you're low on magnesium. Here's some magnesium. And so they're doing the same thing they do with drugs. They're doing it with supplements and hormones. And
absolutely.
Then you say, well, like we said, like your libido's back. Okay. But for some reason I'm in bone loss. My joints are hurting. I'm having dental problems and what's it called? Gum,
like recession.
Yeah. Like gum recession. And, you know, these things that you start to notice as you get into closer to menopause, you say, I just wake up and I'm just put my feet on the ground and the floor and my feet hurt. Like, what the heck is that? You know? And they don't make the connection between estrogen for, potentially running that. Now you said that the, when they started doing all of their, they went bonkers with the hysterectomies, 70s, 80s, 90s. My mom and sister were both in that group of people that were us. Yep, take it all out. That osteoporosis and all the other estrogen related imbalances, issues skyrocketed. So that means that when they took out the uterus and the ovaries, what is that? That means that the estrogen retreated into tissue, or what happened there?
So the ovaries are the primary creator of E2 or estradiol. So once you take the ovaries out, you're now relying upon tissue estrogen, which is primarily estriol. And estrone is usually made by the placenta. Or I'm getting this. I switched those around.
Estriol.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So we have now we have. There's many types of estrogens, actually, many different metabolites of estrogen beyond just E1, E2, and E3. But what happens is now you're relying a little bit more on tissue estrogen, and you've been put into a physical menopause. That's what happened. You're no longer having that sex hormone creation from the ovaries. Now, in an actual menopause, as the ovaries begin to, I guess we could say, decline, or you begin to ovulate less frequently, you have this kind of slow transitional period from perimenopause into menopause. There's usually a few years there where you're ovulating farther and farther apart. So that means you're making a little bit less progesterone. You're becoming a little bit more estrogen dominant, and the adrenals and the thyroid are picking up to pick up that slack, because the adrenals make pregnenolone and DHEA, and DHEA turns into estrogen and testosterone. So the adrenals are capable of actually providing you enough hormones to give you the estrogen needs that you have. If you're no longer in childbearing years, you don't necessarily need this hormone of growth and cellular proliferation. You're no longer reproducing or making breast milk. These things require massive amounts of tissue growth, but they do come with downfalls. You're more sensitive to your environment. You're more sensitive to the cycles of the moon. There's a sensitivity involved there that is kind of, I call it the sacrifice for having all this estrogen. And so when you're going through menopause, you don't need the estrogen levels of a cycling woman, a woman of childbearing years. Nature knows that. If you were supposed to have that robust of estrogen levels, you would have them. But there's a reason why that declines. And see, that slow transition gives the body time to adapt to its new reality. But when you just remove the ovaries in one day, in a traumatic way, right, you're cutting into the body, that's a completely different shift. Hormones just immediately drop. And so the body's having to now pick up the slack for having these organs that have removed. Remember, there's a brain to ovarian connection, a brain to uterine connection. So the brain's now computing that there's no more ovaries, there's no more uterus. It often pumps out a lot of pituitary hormones like prolactin and these other stress hormones, because that's a stressful event. The body's like, oh my gosh, there's no more uterus, there's no more ovaries. So you're going through that. On top of, you have this just dramatic drop in sex hormones. And so the adrenals and thyroid are going to quickly try to pick up the slack. But if your thyroid and adrenals are already struggling, which they most likely are, because most women get their ovaries and their uterus removed because they're having hormonal issues that are being driven by this, now you also have a thyroid and adrenals that can't really pick up the slack because they're struggling as well. And so you have this kind of a storm of hormonal imbalance and having nothing to rely on to keep the balance in your body because all the glands were already struggling, which is very different than when you go through menopause and your body's kind of slowly transitioning and the adrenals and thyroid are taking on more and more slack over time. And if they're healthy, the menopausal transition will be quite calm. And adding in like something like progesterone, which can be a great tool during that time to kind of combat that estrogen dominance that comes from ovulating less frequently, you're going to be in a pretty good place. But a lot of women, like you said, once they hit perimenopause, they're really seeing the effects of their bad habits during their cycling years. And their adrenals and their thyroid are struggling to take on the slack that the ovaries are reducing their impact on the hormonal system. So it's a delicate dance. Let's just put it that way.
So then it's not, you know, that unusual. Like I have pretty low levels of hormones across the board and I'm 52. I'm not fully in menopause. I thought I was. And then of course this 2 moons ago, which was the crazy big, I forget, serpent moon or whatever it was called, full on just had a period. I was like, okay, well, I guess I'm not anymore. But I got excited because I know that the longer a woman menstruates into her older years, they say the longer she'll live, of course, barring she doesn't get hit by a bus crossing the street. But but then, you know, I was thinking like, I mean, I feel healthy anyway, even though my Dutch is shocking. It's like, they're like, sorry, we cannot even read this because it's undetectable to man. But I was like, you know, I feel strong. I'm not having poor muscle recovery. I have my progesterone was fine because I'm taking it orally and topically. And I was like, why do I need to try to force this into a place that it isn't? And you know, I'm 52, so I don't think it's going to be going up unless I supplement, but I aromatize for sure testosterone often. I know that it's happened many times when I tried to take it in the past. So like, it's okay, right? I mean, if your thyroid is okay and you feel metabolically sound, like why do we need to force ourselves into having higher testosterone levels?
Yeah.
Do you agree with that?
I would agree. And I also wonder how many women are going to the doctor to get their hormones tested just because they're going through perimenopause and they're experiencing all these changes. And it's actually from their lifestyle and their habits, but they go and get tested and their hormones are low. And so they say they're experiencing the symptoms because their hormones are low. I've met so many women that take hormones and they still have all the problems they had before they took hormones. So is it really the hormones, or what are the hormones doing for you? And there are a lot of people that speculate. There is some evidence, but it's young, let's just put it that way, that the primary job of hormones is actually to move minerals around, to move other substances around. And if you have enough of these things, then it would mean that if, as long as there's other hormones, like the ones your adrenals are making, your body is going to be fine in that shift or that transition. So we have to really look deeper. There's a lot that's still unexplored in regards to hormones. And I always wonder if women, is it really the low hormones, or is it actually the lifestyle and the nutrition, and you just happen to get tested and their body is compensating with or with, you know, lower hormones or imbalanced hormones? Is it really the hormones, or is it deeper? And that's what we have to look at, because there's so many women that have low hormones that feel amazing. They're incredible. They're strong. They're muscular. Their temperature and pulses are amazing. They're sleeping well. And so what will we say about them if, you know, they have estrogen levels that are undetectable? Like, so what does that mean? So there's a lot of nuance.
That's so interesting. When I had Tom Littlewood on, he was saying, you know, do you have the markers of health? Like if you're sleeping, if you're good digestion, if you have a good mood, if you're, you know, generally a happy person, if you're sleeping, Those are the markers. Otherwise, like, why do you want to do those things to yourself? Why do you want to take
Exactly.
a million nutraceuticals if you're, or if you're taking those nutraceuticals and you're having all those great balanced markers of good health, then, why mess with it, really?
Exactly.
Hey everyone, I wanted to introduce Ona's new ultra concentrated CBD progesterone cream. It's 5% CBD and 3% progesterone for relief of stress, anxiety, minor aches and pains in your muscles and joints. It is US sourced, produced, and naturally derived. It's organically grown. And right now we are doing a special because this particular strength of CBD on the market, which is THC free, normally goes for about $120 for 2 ounces. So we are doing $60 as an introductory offer. And the reason I developed it was because this particular combination with the CBD helps to downregulate cortisol while it helps you to take advantage of the progesterone benefits. The link is in the show notes, or you can go to us.onasnatural.com. And by the way, if you use coupon code ONAS, you'll get an additional 10% off.
Since we let's wrap up the PCOS thing with the insulin resistance component there. Do you have what do you have to say about that? And you did say earlier on about the body needing to make the energy, and then that to me opens the whole door to, you need to make energy, so the body's going to figure it out, and cortisol is going to come into play. So go run with it.
So insulin resistance is interesting because there's such a hyper focus right now on the hormone insulin, and so much so that people actually are forgetting what insulin does. Insulin, it acts almost as a key to allow glucose into the cell. It's a blood sugar lowering hormone. Having enough insulin is good. You want insulin, and you want to be sensitive to insulin. Insulin is not bad. And I feel like a lot of people think insulin is bad. It's a hormone of growth, so it's anabolic, just like estrogen. And so it will be high if we have a lot of catabolic hormones at play. The body does not want to be broken down too much. So cortisol is a catabolic hormone, adrenaline is a catabolic hormone. And what catabolic means is really just the breakdown of tissue. There's either hormones that break down tissue or build it up. And we need a balance of both because we don't want a bunch of old tissue just sticking around. And we definitely don't want, so we want that to be broken down and renewed. And we definitely don't want no growth hormone because we need to recreate and renew ourselves. We need to rebuild ourselves. So we need that balance. But a lot of time, estrogen is anabolic and insulin is anabolic. So when we have all this growth, we also have a lot of, oftentimes have a lot of catabolic hormones at play. And that's where a lot of times insulin is being released because of our elevated cortisol. We're constantly breaking down our own tissue to fuel our brain and our body. There are many tissues in our body that can only run on glucose. Specifically, I always like to highlight the brain and spinal cord of the nervous system. So if we're experiencing, if our nervous system is really responsible for processing what we experience in our environment and our surroundings, and if we're in a constant stressed out state, whether that's externally or internally, like we talked about earlier, that emotional distress, we are going to be breaking our own tissues down if we are not providing our bodies enough fuel. And let's be honest, most women are not providing their bodies enough fuel at all on a regular, consistent basis. And this is what becomes the problem. So there are other hormones at play oftentimes behind insulin resistance, and insulin resistance is being focused on so heavily that people forget about the importance of leptin. They forget about the importance of glucagon. So glucagon is insulin's, I guess we could say, evil twin brother, where insulin is the blood sugar lowering hormone and glucagon is the blood sugar raising hormone. And I don't understand why we're so focused on insulin when glucagon is often at play. And glucagon is actually stimulated by adrenaline. So when the adrenals start pumping out adrenaline, the body starts to break down its own tissue to increase and raise blood sugar. And that's what glucagon is doing. Insulin is there to lower blood sugar. But the reason that we're resistant to it is oftentimes we have all these other hormones, the cortisol, the glucagon, the adrenaline, that are really overtaking the system as a whole. And then we have poor thyroid function, which adds to insulin resistance, and then magnesium deficiency, which is a huge deal. And then we also have a lot of times these gut infections. And when there's a lot of endotoxin or that metabolic byproduct that comes from that bacteria coming from the gut, it really impairs the liver. It puts a lot of stress on the liver. Any type of adrenal overactivity puts a lot of stress on the liver because the liver is having to convert protein into sugar, which is a huge job. It's called gluconeogenesis. And then we also have a lot of times if the gut bacteria is imbalanced, we have that extra added effect of endotoxin. And we have to remember that that's where thyroid hormone mainly gets converted from T4 into T3. And so if you have a bunch of endotoxin or bacterial overload, and then you're also spending all of your liver's energy on just converting protein into carbohydrate to feed your brain, your liver is going to put thyroid conversion on the back burner. It doesn't have the nutrients or the capacity to do it in its optimal way. So that is usually the driver of insulin resistance. I would say a very burdened liver, not balancing your blood sugar. So you're eating, you know, huge amounts of protein or huge amounts of carbohydrate, or you're going long periods of time without eating or kind of snacking throughout the day, drinking black coffee on an empty stomach. And then of course your body's starving. So then you'll binge and then you just do it all over again instead of providing your body that regular, consistent fueling. So most people have insulin resistance from what's going on in the gut. Mineral imbalances, specifically magnesium deficiency, sodium deficiency is a big one too. The need for salt is huge. Potassium allows the cells to take up blood sugar, and potassium, our needs for potassium are quite high. Most people do not get enough. You know, 4,700 milligrams is the body's basic need. And that is a very difficult number to hit for most people. So we have this mixture of issues that are driving the body's inability to respond to insulin properly. And it's mostly to keep blood sugar in the blood so that the brain can uptake it. All the cells are struggling getting that energy. So insulin resistance is actually a starvation of the cells. People don't realize that. The fat cells are becoming more insulin sensitive, and like cells like the brain cells are becoming more insulin resistant. Very rarely are you going to have all the cells being resistant to insulin. The fat cells are becoming more sensitive so that they store more fuel, and some of the cells are actually becoming more resistant so that the fat cells can store. It's a survival response. That's what insulin resistance is. It's a storage of fuel for later. That's what your fat cells are.
Wow. So this really explains a lot when women start to get into perimenopause and menopause, the insomnia, because you know, like out of the blue, like it just starts happening, and you know, you haven't changed anything. You've not changed the way you eat or anything. And, you know, now you're waking up in the middle of the night at 3 a.m. and it's just this, I guess that when maybe you can iron that out a little bit for me, when the, you know, when your hormone levels drop and your estrogen like retreats into the tissues, and then all of a sudden this, also the emergency hormone thing that you always talk about, we're running on these emergency hormones. It's an issue of getting to this certain age where your body just can't do that. And it, like my mom says, it can't rob Peter to pay Paul anymore. Exactly. Now it's got no fuel. So it's waking you up because your brain is going into a hangry moment in the middle of the night. Yes. And that's what's happening, right?
Yes. And it's, and you may have some extra fat on your body. You know, fat is just, I like to simplify it as just really a place where we store extra fuel. So you might be like, well, I have plenty of fat for my body to tap into, but tapping into fat actually takes a lot of energy, and it takes good thyroid function. And like I said before, during that transition, especially from perimenopause to menopause, as the ovaries are not ovulating as regularly, you're not getting that progesterone. And so remember, we need progesterone and thyroid hormone to actually get estrogen from the tissues into the bloodstream. So that's what's happening, is it's the progesterone decline as well as the thyroid decline, and then the excess stress hormones like cortisol and adrenaline that drives the estrogen to the tissues. The estrogen no longer has what it needs to move freely and properly. So and that's where you can actually experience some excess estrogen symptoms and low estrogen symptoms, what we call like kind of that classic like vaginal atrophy or dryness, the hot flashes. It's partially being driven by the adrenals as well, because now the adrenals are taking the brunt of the weight of the ovaries. The adrenals are starting to pump out more hormones, or needing to keep the body balanced, but there's a lack of energy issue. And so the adrenals are now pumping out and these stimulating hormones. And that's why you're kind of not sleeping well at night. You're waking up. You can't fall into that deep sleep. You're also maybe your dopamine might be off. So your neurotransmitters, so your feel good hormones, your happy hormones, are kind of reducing, and you're also experiencing this need for fuel. You're no longer able, you don't have the capacity anymore to go these long periods of time without eating or handle these huge amounts of stress. This is really the time that highlights you the need to take care of yourself.
Right. Yeah. The inability. I mean, I was never someone who could really deal with stress anyway, but it's noticeable now where I'm like, Wow, just like the littlest things, and you just feel your whole body go into like alert, you know?
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay, let's talk about fibroids and other things we grow quickly. So here's just a question. Any advice for ovarian cysts and fibroids without the use of progesterone? Yeah, so that's mostly the and that's been a common question. Like people feel like they don't want to have to rely on progesterone. They feel like if they start taking it, and I think this has to do with the misinformation promoted by the progestin and the estrogen industry, just making you think that if you take progesterone, your body will stop making it. But we know that, thanks to Repeat, that that's not the case at all. In fact, it can even encourage production. And so, yeah, what do you say about to someone who has been hearing that if you take progesterone, it can actually even dissolve some cysts and fibroids depending on the size, but if they don't want to use progesterone?
So usually these growths are in part being driven by the inability to break down tissue, and obviously something that's encouraging continual tissue growth, which we know oftentimes is at least in part estrogen. There can be other things at play. Prolactin can cause an imbalance of calcium, which can have metabolic effects. And then, stress in general can deplete us of nutrients that we need to regulate these cells, because I see everything in terms of cells. The uterine cells, the body's not going to just expend energy to grow these cells unless the body thinks it's important. And so what is it protecting us from? And there's a lot of times some emotional components there as well. This is why I love kind of exploring German New Medicine. I think for anybody that is not aware of the emotional components of what's going on in their body, that's a really important thing to take note of. There's German New Medicine, traditional Chinese medicine, even Louise Hay. They all have some great insight about the emotional drivers behind these issues, especially when it comes to the reproductive system. But when we look at the physical drivers, there oftentimes is that imbalance between estrogen and progesterone. So when it comes to fibroids, as the name really clarifies, is they have a lot to do with something called fibrosis. And fibrosis is talked about a lot in kind of this, I guess we could call it the pro-metabolic or the bioenergetic kind of repeat space, where he brought light to the fact that this it's almost like a scar tissue buildup, if we want to simplify it, where the body is building up scar tissue and unable to break down certain proteins, or not wanting to for some reason. And so a lot of people do end up using what's called proteolytic enzymes to break down fibroids, or systemic enzymes. These are
Like
enzymes
serapeptidase and things like that.
exactly like papain and stuff like that, bromelain. But these are enzymes that, well, some of them are ones that our pancreas would actually make in the digestive system to help us break down proteins. They're protein digesting enzymes, but when taken on an empty stomach, they actually absorb systemically and can go into the bloodstream, and they can help break down other proteins that have been kind of building up in the body. So that sometimes works for some people, especially when it comes to fibroids. When it comes to cysts, a lot of people need to start looking at their iodine levels. So iodine and selenium both play a big role in clearing fluid from the body, lymph fluid, yes, but other fluids. And usually when you look at cysts, they're kind of fluid-filled sacs. And so they have a lot to do with the lymph system and fluid clearing. And so oftentimes when people have these growths, whether it be cysts on the ovaries or cysts, there's different types of cysts under the skin, armpits, groin, people grow cysts all over. This often is driven by estrogen, but iodine and selenium are needed to break down estrogen in the liver. Selenium is the precursor to glutathione. So these two minerals are very important and oftentimes are a big culprit in both like sore and tender, swollen breast and ovarian cysts. But when it comes to fibroids, a lot of times it's an estrogen driver. And then this kind of fibrosis state where you're building all this tissue. And the pancreas is an important organ that sometimes gets overlooked. Every time that we eat and we drop our food from our stomach, which is full, mixed with hydrochloric acid, which is very acidic, as it drops into the small intestine, the pancreas pumps out a neutralizer called bicarbonate. This is an important neutralizer. And for a lot of us, our pancreas is struggling, especially if we're overproducing insulin or we're producing tons of glucagon, which we talked about earlier. earlier, these are both pancreas hormones. And the pancreas also makes us enzymes to break down tissue, break down food. And so if our stress system is overproducing cortisol and adrenaline, it's going to stimulate insulin and glucagon, and we're going to be hurting for both for protein digesting enzymes. And that's going to impact our food, but also tissue growth throughout the body.
Wow. This comes back to what my mentor said. It's just comes back to the gut again and digestion. Yep. How are you digesting what you're eating? Are you digesting what you're eating? What's your hydrochloric acid production like? And, you know, my whole career, I've never encouraged isolating minerals, like taking, you know, iodine in isolation or iron in isolation. Magnesium might be the only thing maybe, but, and I've just always felt like, because they're so synergistic and they require their synergistic counterparts and whatnot. But iodine, that's one of the questions. Someone was asking about iodine for fibroids and cysts and things. But you encourage taking iodine, supplementing iodine.
I think it's a contextual thing. Iodine is definitely not the first thing somebody should do, just because it is synergistic with many other nutrients such as zinc and copper and magnesium. So iodine is not something you want to just take randomly or take without thought. And it works very closely with selenium. So it's very important for our selenium levels to be at a good place before anyone ever considers supplementing iodine. It's very contextual based on where people are at, but I have heard of many people supplementing iodine too soon when their body's not resilient enough. Mm-hmm. And because it causes so much bromide detoxification, which are going to be those halides. So fluoride, chlorine, bromide, which is like what you smell when furniture is off gassing, or that new car smell. It's the flame retardants, which mm-hmm. are often, unfortunately, most things are required to be sprayed in flame retardants, car seats, mattresses, things like that. So we have a lot of those just stored up in our fat cells. And when somebody starts taking iodine, that iodine actually displaces those things because they're all so molecularly similar. So it will displace chlorine, it will displace fluoride, it will displace the bromide and other halides. And so that can actually end up causing a huge detoxification reaction. It comes out oftentimes through the skin. It's very important for your drainage pathways to be open, for your body to already be in a resilient place. Mm-hmm. And to work on the more basic things, like making sure you're eating nutrient dense foods and balancing your blood sugar and getting your liver and your oysters and your raw carrot and making sure things are kind of smoothly flowing before you get more into those kind of trace minerals.
Yeah. Well, that brings up the issue of, you know, xenoestrogens, which is something I ask every single guest that is in your space with hormones. It's including Georgie Dinkoff, who said, yeah, and Carol Peterson were like, yeah, we don't know. don't know what they're doing. We don't know if they're showing up as in blood work as an estrogen. Exactly. We don't know anything. And they could be playing a role, a really toxic role in, you know, this transition we make into perimenopause and menopause, or someone have any kind of inflammatory condition where they could be mimicking estrogen and acting like estrogen. We just have, it's like the wild card in our bodies in the last, 20 years or more?
Not very long.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I do know, I mean, there's a lot of research that shows that women with endometriosis are very sensitive to xenoestrogen. They specifically react to PCBs. And so I don't think it would be a far stretch to say that fibroids, which are also affecting that endometrial tissue, are being impacted in some way by xenoestrogens, you know? And I also know that many of the clients that I've worked with, they found that when they were more estrogen dominant, they were very reactive to the xenoestrogens in their environment. And then as they got their body to a better place of balance, it's almost as if their body is able to process through these things and excrete them at faster rates. They're not as sensitive to these things anymore.
Interesting. Wow. I mean, that just opens up my mind to so many different ideas about what we experience. Well, you said earlier, which was fascinating, our body is not going to spend the energy to make a cyst or a fibroid or some kind of mass if it isn't meaning to do that, whether it's intelligently or not. It's doing something to protect you in some way. And maybe it's, you know, if you could like assay these things, like these fibroids and these masses, and wouldn't it be interesting to find that they were all xenoestrogens that were just from all the beauty products that all of us women are so highly exposed to, everything we're exposed to that everyone else is exposed to, but then we add because we're doing the cleaning in the house and we're doing the makeup and the hair dye and all the things. And
Exactly.
that would be that way. And then let's not forget our good old trusty friend, the medicated birth control,
Yes.
which is just thrown such a wrench in the spokes, honestly,
Yes.
of hormones.
Absolutely, absolutely. And there has been people also throw around the idea that they could be parasitic related as well, that some of these cysts, if they're bursting, what's going on? What's bursting out of them? That's another kind of rabbit hole that I think needs to be gone down. I wish there was more research being put into these things. Like you said, actually cutting these.
My mentor was very much into that. He said, you know, he the amoeba type parasites, not so much like intestinal ropeworms or things like that, but maybe, but amoeba, like, you know, Giardia and things that we think because we're no longer testing for it in our stool or whatever, that we must not have it. And he said he's convinced that it's showing up in other ways, from dental tissue, you know, the flesh of our mouths, in our what is it called? Our
Like interstitial.
yeah, but like our abdomen, the out the between the abdominal wall and our guts, like that whole area. He was like, that's where a lot of them lay their eggs, is, you know, in there. And we just can't find them. They're not going to excrete into your stool necessarily, so
No.
you may not see them there.
Yeah. And they're the masters of survival. So you're testing stool that's coming out. Well, they could still be inside. If they didn't come out, then that means there's still a problem. But yeah, I would agree. They definitely can hang out in that omentum tissue, which is that lymphoid tissue, that is like in kind of that lower belly area.
You know, I had Dr. Perry Nicholson on not too long ago from Stop Chasing the Pain, and he was so fascinating.
He's
He was
so
talking
good.
so good. I mean, yeah, it had a lot of moments like we're having here where I'm just like, wait, 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 what? But yeah, talking about that massive lymph space in your abdomen, and all the garbage that collects there. And then, you know, you couple that with what you just said about cysts, and these things have to go somewhere. And the body doesn't want them liberated into the blood to get into your brain and your eyeballs. So it's going to find a way, whether it's using candida to sequester it against the gut wall, or using biofilms, or using whatever. It's like these tools, I think it is intelligent. I think the body's trying to protect itself, right? So let's motivate it.
And our environment is so toxic. How can we say that these are the drivers of issues, whereas the body might just be trying to keep some sort of balance?
Yeah, I don't think our body's ever trying to kill itself, is the moral to that story. Okay, let's see. So just let's wrap this up with some progesterone questions. I mean, I could go on all day, but let's go with these questions. Is progesterone making me hungry? I said yes, because it needs fuel, like Dr. Dalton told us all. But what does it is it making me hungry?
It definitely has a thyroid stimulating effect. This is why most women are going to get a little hungrier after they ovulate during their luteal phase. There's also a shift from when we have a more estrogen dominated part of our cycle, like during the follicular phase, we're going to have a need for more fats and a little bit more carbohydrate. Whereas in the progesterone, if we're not having enough carbohydrate, we are going to start to actually make more stress hormones because we do need a little bit more fuel. That's why the body temperature is raising, you're seeing that direct impact on the thyroid. So for some women, they do find that if they supplement too much progesterone, it's a little too much. So finding that sweet spot's important, but it's normal to get a little hungrier and need a couple hundred extra calories.
Yeah, and that makes sense also. If women get panic attacks or anxiety when they take progesterone, women are like, it's converting to cortisol. And that might be true, but it actually sounds like an adrenaline response to the fact that they don't have enough fuel, right? That's
Exactly,
probably more
exactly.
likely.
Yeah, that's why in my courses, I usually recommend spending 3 to 6 months really focusing on balancing your blood sugar and getting your stress hormones down before even thinking about bioidentical progesterone supplementation. Unless, of course, it's always case by case, but for a majority of women, they respond to progesterone better once they've gotten their blood sugar balance first.
That's really good advice, because so many women gain weight, a lot of weight on, but some of them it's water weight and it'll go within like the first 3 months. But some of them, I mean, it's the pounds. It's like the blubbery fat that sticks around. I mean, anywhere from 5 to 20, 30 pounds. Some of these women
Yes.
are struggling so bad. And I feel bad because on one hand, you're so depleted. Like I was able to push right through my adrenal fatigue. When I started progesterone, I was fine. It actually helped me with panic attacks and helped me calm down a lot. And I know that's the case for a lot of women, but for, and I
Yes.
did have, some insulin issues, but I was on the skinny fat side. And so, was that what it's called? Skinny fat. And so it was different for me. But some women are not, So I'm starting to say, yeah, if you are putting on the pounds and you don't see any progress, it's kind of like with working on your thyroid, like Kate Deering says, and you say, yeah, when you start it, you're going to probably gain some weight, but you want to be able to be seeing some progress with the progesterone. If you're not, and you're just putting on 20 pounds, I think there's what things that are being overlooked.
I know Jenny Birdsey. I don't know if you've ever read her book. It's called Natural Progesterone, The World's Best Kept Secret. I love that book.
No,
Oh,
let me
it's
write
for
that
free on
down.
her website too, which is amazing. But she has so many wonderful insights about the spiritual side of progesterone and
Ooh,
how,
say the title again.
it's Natural Progesterone, The World's Best Kept
Natural
Secret.
progesterone, the world's best kept secret.
And then, yes, Jenny Birdsey,
Jenny.
Birdsey.
Okay.
Yeah,
So.
she talks about some amazing I impacts of progesterone that not a lot of people talk about, specifically the spiritual side, and how when our progesterone is low, it really steals that ability to kind of flow and like let things go and just respond to the beauty and the truth around us and really enjoy life and stay present. But she talks about how if you supplement too little, especially at first when you're very estrogen dominant, she was a, I think, like a nurse practitioner, so she worked with lots of women, and she said that there's this initial kind of estrogen surge because progesterone moves estrogen. So if you have a bunch of estrogen in your tissues and you start supplementing progesterone, that estrogen's going to start to move and mobilize into the bloodstream. And if it's not being detoxified well, if the liver and the gut are not really supported, it's just going to keep going round and round and round because that beta glucuronidase, that bacteria is just going to reactivate that estrogen. It's going to reabsorb. And that is where that initial weight gain happens. And so she actually sometimes recommended, at least she talks about this in her work, of increasing the dose for a little while to balance out that excess estrogen that's coming out of the tissue. And that's where a lot of women, if they're having negative side effects, especially the weight gain, it's most likely that they're getting this movement, but they're not excreting estrogen out of the body properly or well. And that's what's happening. There's not enough progesterone to balance out the estrogen that's moving out of the tissues.
I'm so glad you said that. We call it estrogen kickback in the group
Oh, that's a
because,
great term.
yeah, because it's like, clearly that's what's happening. And so, the progesterone therapy website, Ray White, she was wonderful. Her information was great. Carol Peterson, did a lot of work with women with PMDD. And dosing every 20 minutes until these women were sometimes up at 800, 1,000 milligrams. I know I was at 800 milligrams for an entire year, a day. But
Wow.
she said, you're not absorbing that. There's no way. You don't need 800 milligrams a day of progesterone. If you were pregnant, maybe, you would be at that point at some point in your pregnancy. But 800 milligrams, there's something going on with absorption. Whether
Yes.
it's hypothyroid and the skin is having an issue absorbing, and your keratinocytes are in slow-mo, or whether candida or metals or la la la, all these different things. And so my group gets a lot of slack that I hear up through the grapevine because I'm like, hey, go up and dose, go up and dose until your symptoms subside. And if you see no progress, then something's being overlooked. Otherwise, go up and dose until it's gone. Let me tell you, that is a magical thing for a lot of women to all of a sudden be terrified and their doctors are yelling at them because they're at 400 milligrams on their own or 500, and the doctors are yelling at them and they're like, listen, I have never been happier, so back off. So I can't wait to read that book. That's really exciting. And I'm sure you feel like it's case dependent, obviously, like you did with everything. So it's not easy to just comment, which is one of the problems I have in my group is trying to, and working for Ona's is trying to help people with dosing because it's like, listen, your doctor's not going to like this and you need to make this decision yourself. But there might be an issue with absorption, or you might need to eat more carbs, or, you know, there's so many things.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. All you covered all of these on your own. Let's see. So, you know, sometimes I say this to people about fibroids, sometimes they have to come out. They're just in the way. They have this blood source. They're just, okay. You agree with that.
Yes. Yeah. Especially if they're big, you know, I've worked with women who have fibroids the size of grapefruits are huge, and it's causing heaviness. Like it's achy, like they can feel it, and it's affecting their pelvic floor. It's pushing against their digestive system. So it's always a case by case basis.
Mm-hmm. There's a random question here. What do you think about healing hypothalamic amenorrhea?
Oh yeah. So a lot of people, especially in this, in the hormonal space, this often happens to young girls, but it can happen at any time where you lose your period and you're having a hard time getting it back. But it's very often going to be somebody that is over-exercising or very, very lean for their body type. And this opens up a whole new conversation I've had with a lot of my followers. We had thousands of women respond to this, but there's a lot of aspects of development from your fifth from about 15 to 25. The female brain doesn't start to stop developing until the age of 25, and there's a lot of body changes that happen from puberty up until 25. Most women have probably noticed that they're, you know, they have their teenage body, their late teenage body, their early 20 body, and then like mid to late 20s their body shifted again into a more, I guess, what we call womanly form. But some women miss out on this because they're under eating, chronically dieting, or on birth control during this time. Mm-hmm. And this is, I've actually been able to find some connections with even the development of the breast tissue that creates milk. And so there are some women now being diagnosed with glandular tissue insufficiency, where the glandular tissue, they might have breasts, but they don't have enough glandular tissue to create milk. So there's lots of impacts down the line. But when we look at this leanness, there's oftentimes this like childlike leanness that has never left a woman's body. That's usually where the hypothalamic amenorrhea often happens. I've never worked with a woman who has hypothalamic amenorrhea that hasn't had some type of emotional stressor, some type of hormonal stressor like birth control, some type of like physical stressor like an eating disorder, or overexercise, or even being like a high school or collegiate athlete. This is it often happens with them as well. They're overexercising and they're just not consciously understanding that they're under eating, mostly because they're just jumping from practice, you know, morning practice to school to late afternoon practice to meets. You know, they're just working out constantly. They're stressed with their finals, their exams, their schoolwork, and then on top of it, they're not eating enough. And so this is where a lot of women who have hypothalamic amenorrhea need to really evaluate their habits, and not just their habits now, but what their habits have been the past 10, 15, 20 years. Because the body is kind of, I call it a snowball effect or a rollover effect. You know, last month's cycle is rolling over into this cycle. So if you ovulated well last cycle, you're going to have a better cycle this month, because that progesterone is going to help balance out the estrogen, and every month subsequently is going to get a little bit better or a little worse. I know when I have a bad cycle or a bad ovulation, the next cycle is harder for me as well. And so the female body is really accumulative. It's not every day is kind of a reset like the male physiology. The female physiology is a 28-day, a very cyclical rhythm. And if one thing gets knocked off in the rhythm, like Dr. Katharina Dalton talks about how one day of adrenaline or having imbalanced blood sugar can affect your ability to respond to progesterone for 7 days afterwards. So it's very important to remember this, like a rollover effect. And so when a woman's struggling with a loss of a period, which is really a loss of an ovulation, a lot of women, when they lose their period, they're so focused on the period that they forget. It's not just a loss of a period, it's a loss of an ovulation. And to ovulate, we need so much energy. We need a lot of nutrients, and we need safety. The body doesn't really want to drop an egg and have it possibly be fertilized when you're in a famine, when your body's responding to a stressful environment or an internally stressful environment. So it's really important to evaluate the possible emotional drivers that could be behind there. Even if you maybe had an eating disorder in the past and you're no longer struggling with the actual eating part of it, but maybe the mental part of it is still there, where there's a lot of beating up of the body, poor body image, that can be a huge one. Or if you were an athlete, you know, if your body has changed, because when you're not an athlete anymore, your body's going to change. You're not putting it under that intense amount of stress and pressure anymore. And so that can be a big stressor in a lot of different ways, an emotional stressor, but also a physical stressor. So it's not as simple as just stop exercising and eat more. You know, there are a lot of like little nuances and more complicated details there. But at the end of the day, I've helped so many women overcome their hypothalamic amenorrhea just from eating enough, eating frequently. Sometimes they need to get their calories up to, especially if they're chronic under eaters, to like 3,000 or 4,000 calories for a period of time to get their appetite back. Because oftentimes, once their appetite really comes back, they start to eat a ton. They're so hungry. It's like they're making up for a decade of not eating enough. And they often have to gain a little bit of weight. Now, this is not true for everyone. Some people who have hypothalamic amenorrhea are already overweight, and that's usually due to estrogen dominance. So that's like almost like a more like a PCOS type situation. They have estrogen dominance, imbalanced hormones, maybe the insulin resistance that's causing the cells to not respond to glucose properly. But when there's a lot of an underweight situation, it's almost always the need to just eat and stress less. So not push yourself in any way. Like if you're looking at it as a pendulum, you swung one way, you pushed yourself for years and years and years and years. Now it's time to swing the other way for a little while and just give yourself a break. Rest mentally, physically, and eat, and expect that your body wants to cycle. It's trying hard every month to cycle. It's working hard to get that cycle back. And there could be many ducks that it's putting in a row that might take months and months and months. And you might say, oh, I'm not getting my period back yet. I'm not getting my period back. But I want you to think of your ovulation as the fruit of your system. So a tree is not going to produce fruit until everything else is in line. The fruit is the last thing to be produced. And you want to think of your ovulation like that too. Your body's not going to expend that energy until it's put all its other ducks in a row. But it can take time.
That's beautiful. I love that because I think something that women expect, they like when we talk about progesterone, starting progesterone, it's and we say give it 3 months to start to find balance, and it's usually you'll start to see when you do it with consistency, whatever, if you're doing it daily or if you're doing it cyclically or whatever. You'll start to see balance in 3 months. And women get very frustrated with that because in that 3 months, so many things can happen. Just in 3 days, where you're just feeling like blissed out and feel so great. And all of a sudden, everything goes wrong. And you're just like, it's the progesterone. And then you get off of it. And then you're like, oh, I'm worse. And you get back on it. And it can be such a yo-yo thing. And so, something that I definitely would say to women is that, be patient with yourself because it is, and think of it in terms of planting seeds and growing things. Because even if you're in menopause and you're not going to ovulate, there's still a cycle that your body goes through, and we have to like support that cycle. But it's that you have to be patient. I was a chronic undereater. I definitely had hypothalamic amenorrhea for sure. I didn't have a period till I was 18. Didn't have, and then when I did, it was, scanty and rarely there because I didn't eat. I never ate. I was on, and it comes back down to the same thing you started off talking about, which is, working on emergency hormones. You're running on adrenaline and cortisol and all those things that keep us in a state of fight or flight, right? So how are we supposed to grow babies? Let alone just have a period, just have a normal period, or lose weight or anything.
And I would say, I would add a note is, how are we supposed to grow our bones? A lot of people that have started my Fully Nourished course, even in their late 20s or early 30s, their pelvis grows, their whole bone structure changes. They actually, it's like their body almost, they go through almost like a new puberty. So there's something that goes on. If we're under eating during that time, it doesn't mean it's too late. I've had women into their late 40s actually have complete body shifts as well. Bigger breasts, bigger hips, wider hips. Just a complete distribution of fat, or redistribution, I should say. So it
That's
is
so
interesting.
interesting because I was that thin, that what you were lean thing you were talking about, where people thought I was like work out or I'm a dancer or whatever, and I did like nothing. I mean, I did, but I never did it consistently. And then when I started doing progesterone and I was already heading towards perimenopause and I wasn't able to have children, But I was starting to work on thyroid stuff. I was starting to work on balance. Yeah, I was like, where are these hips coming from? I mean, I always had boobs, but I was like, my body is definitely changing. And now I'm like, okay, stop changing. You can stop now.
We're done. That's crazy.
You had a post that was the cortisol belly, you
Oh,
know?
yes.
And I think that's the point that I'm at now, where it's like, you know, it's just hanging out in that apron there. That's like, okay, that's clearly not just fat. And I was bummed because when I met Constantine, I was doing like the bulletproof coffee. Like I was fasting in the morning and going to work out for like 27 minutes, pretty, not too intensely, but intensely for me. And I lost like 15 pounds. I was like, yes.
Yeah,
And
you're like, yes.
then I met Constantine. And he introduced me to Georgie and Danny and, you know, you and all these people who've just completely shifted my thinking. And I feel better in so many ways, but I'm like, what's up with this
Where
belly?
did you come from? The way that I look at it is I find that, and this is true for my community as well, is, you know, we have thousands of women in there now, and it's the body's more responsive to stress, as it should always be. Before, we responded with this kind of starvation where we just ate through all of our tissue and ate through all of our fat cells, whereas now our body's actually doing what it's supposed to, which is to protect us. And sometimes the stress comes later. You know, we go through all this stress and then all of a sudden we come down from that stress and our body gains the weight then. So it's very much a cycle of the body now is having to recover from all the things that I call it the corners that were cut when we were under stress. Now it's having to go back and redo all those corners that we kind of cut, and it can be kind of uncomfortable, but it's usually it will get to a place where it easily falls off when the body's ready.
Yeah, I noticed that if I'm just walking, it really just falls right off. If I'm consistently walking, you know, it's not as it comes off easier. And you said something that made me laugh and think of with the whole concept behind all the ketogenic and fasting and paleos and all these things.
Yes.
And that those are like the cut corner diets. That's what it is,
Yeah.
isn't it? It's the hydroxy cut
Yes.
of healthy living,
Yeah.
where you're gonna have to pay that back at
Yeah.
some point. Your body's
Yeah.
gonna be like, enjoy
Yeah.
it because
Yeah.
you're gonna have to pay the piper soon.
Yeah. Yeah. You racked up all your metabolic debt and you're going to pay it sooner rather than later.
Yeah, that credit card, the debtors are calling, right?
Yeah.
Well, I think these are all my questions. I do want to throw in
Amazing.
one thing if you have a second
Of
to just
course.
add.
I have plenty
And
of
it's
time.
a kind of a big one,
Okay.
but hair loss
Yeah.
since we have a little time. So I know there are many drivers. Dr. Carrie Jones did a wonderful video that I always save and share to people on all the different reasons people can have hair loss.
Yes.
And there are so many, but there are some that are way more common than others. And a lot of times people will blame it on DH on testosterone and androgens, and then I look at their Dutch and I'm like, their 5-alpha reductase is fine, and their testosterone's okay, and they're not favoring the alpha pathway. And then I look at their cortisol pattern and it's like upside down, and
Yes.
they're taking a multivitamin that has like I don't know how many grams of iron in it
Oh,
or
yeah.
whatever, you know.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, I don't think it's what you think it is. So speak on that a little bit.
Yeah, so usually right now I'll say if you go and Google, you know, why is my hair falling out? The two most popular ideas behind it are going to be anemia and oh, just take iron. And then the other one is going to be DHT is the driver, which is a metabolite, I guess we could say, of testosterone. And that has actually never been proven. So when you look at the research, that is still very early new research. But what happened is when finasteride, which is the, if people don't know what that is, it's the topical hair loss medication that's often prescribed, which has a lot of negative hormonal effects. When that started to become a very popular drug, it kind of everything else, any more research that would have been done just got swept under the rug because it was like, well, DHT is the driver and finasteride blocks DHT. And so that's what we're going to go with. But when Danny Roddy has written that great book called Hair Like a Fox, where he talks about this, and it's very just fascinating to see why we believe that DHT as a driver. There's very little research to support that or evidence to support that. But when you take that off the table and you say, okay, well, it's not testosterone, it's not DHT that's the driver. What is it? Well, when you look at the hair cycle, the hair goes through multiple cycles, the growing phase, the resting phase, and then the actual fall phase. This is oftentimes what's going on, in addition to the follicle itself not functioning properly, or the hair shaft itself starting to thin. And so we have a lot of drivers here. The hair follicle themselves, they rely heavily on glucose. So ding, 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 that's our first issue, right? Hair follicles are like little mini organs almost, and they have a high need for energy. And when those follicles are starved of glucose, that's the minute they start to go downhill. We have to remember that glucose requires strong amounts of thyroid hormone to get into the cell, as well as potassium, sodium, magnesium. So if we have these nutrient deficiencies, our hair follicles are going to have a hard time getting the glucose. And for people that don't know this, there is a lot of more spiritual beliefs behind hair, that hair is an extension of the nervous system. And I like to bring up the story of the Native Americans were very, very, very powerful trackers. They were very in tune with their environment and could track just about anything. They had a almost sixth sense to them. And when the American Army came, or the US Army came in and asked the Native Americans to join the army to become trackers for them, they gave them that typical military haircut, buzzed their head, and they started to realize very quickly they couldn't track anymore. They had no sense of direction. They could not track the way that they could. And so they made an exception to allow them to grow their hair out. And sure enough, when they grew their hair back out, they could track again. And so that's often used as a pointer to there's something with the hair that is giving the body a sixth sense, or almost some type of response to its environment. And it may actually be a extension of the nervous system. And then we look at, traditional Chinese medicine or Ayurveda, they believe that the hair is very connected to the bone health. So if our bones are unhealthy, then the hair will be unhealthy, and the minerals involving the bone also involve the hair. And so when we look at people who have just such deficiency in magnesium and boron, these very powerful minerals that build bone, it would make sense that they're also losing their hair. And then there's those hormonal drivers like prolactin and estrogen that can starve the hair of energy as well, or create these byproducts like nitric oxide or things like that that can starve or cause the mitochondria to not be able to get the energy that it needs. The hair also needs light. The mitochondria need light to be able to produce energy. So that's a huge one as well. But at the end of the day, it's really an energy deficiency. And no matter where we're struggling with it, I know a lot of people say there are many different drivers to hair loss, which they are, but they often almost always funnel down to an energy issue. And there are different factors that are going to impact the way that the cells or the hair cells get energy, but at the end of the day, it's an energy deficiency issue. That those mini organelles, if we want to call them that, are not getting what they need, or there are actual things that are impacting them, like excessive iron or excessive estrogen or excessive endotoxin coming from the gut or excessive stress hormones that are impacting their ability to get that energy. So that's kind of I do have a five video series on YouTube about hair loss. People want to dive into that a little bit more. It's free to watch. I just thought I would
Oh,
mention
nice.
it.
I'll put that
But
in the show notes. Perfect.
it definitely is an energy issue. And that's why so many women, they'll chase all these different supplements. And when they start to actually balance their blood sugar, get their stress levels down, sleep normally, be more intentional with the light that they're getting, not as much blue light, getting more red light, getting more sunlight, they start to see huge responses in the hair. And that's why the nervous system is related.
Yeah, interesting. I don't know why I've always had really good hair and nails. I used to say I think it's because I've had a lot of heavy metal toxicity and I think it's being pushed out. My hair is trying to push it out through the hair and through the hair and nails.
That's possible.
I mean, it's very bizarre for sure. But I am American Indian, so and I do have a really good sense of direction, but when my hair is short, I haven't noticed. So maybe if I ever cut it, I'll be keen on whether that changes my sense
Yeah,
of
where?
direction.
Yeah, I would love to hear. Yeah, you have
Yeah.
the beautiful gray.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I've had this one since I was started growing since I was 19. That's why it's
Oh,
so
wow.
much whiter than everything else. But and that was just, birth control pill very, very young, sick since I was born, just always deficient. And so yeah, I guess that's why I was going gray so early, I guess. But we use our weaknesses and turn them into strengths, right?
Yep. I love it. I love
This
it.
was so wonderful. I'm so grateful. You really are just fantastic. And your demeanor and your delivery and your sweet face. I just love everything about you.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Kitty. It was such a pleasure.
I am addicted to her. And now that I've met her, I just like love her so much. So go into the show notes and make sure you click on her series on YouTube for hair loss, because it's a really, really common question that everyone's always asking about hair loss. And she covers it in many different ways. So you're going to want to check that out. Also, if you'd like to buy some Ona's progesterone or any of the Ona's plant-based hormone products, you can use her coupon code, which is J as in Jessica, A-S-H as in Ash, and the number 15 as in 15% off, J-Ash-15, and get 15% off of your entire order, plus the multi-product discounts that we always have on there. And the Calm Cream, which she said was her favorite product, which is, of course, the product that I developed. It is a 3% progesterone with a CBD from hemp. It doesn't have any THC in it. It's an incredible product. It helps downregulate cortisol while it brings balance to progesterone levels. So guys, check it all out. All of that information, including her info on her courses and how to reach out to her, it's all in the show notes. Make sure you follow her Instagram and mine, healthygutgirl_. All right, friends, thanks.